I'd like now to welcome to the program Doug Starr. He is the author of the book The Killer of Little Shepherds, a true crime story and the birth of forensic science. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So this book interweaves the story of an absolutely horrible serial killer in late 19th century France, Joseph Vacher, and the early scientists and legal thinkers who invented the modern practice of forensics. Let's talk first about Vacher. I'm assuming he's as well known in France as Jack the Ripper is here. Who was he and what did he do?
He's actually less well known in France than you would think. He was a serial killer, one of the most well known of the century, who roamed around the French countryside. He was a vagabond, and he would prey on young people who at the time tended to be shepherds. And he'd get farm jobs, and then the mood would overtake him, and he'd stalk some poor young person out into the fields and kill the person and mutilate the body horribly. He killed anywhere from 11 to 25 people over a three-year period before he was finally stopped.
It's one of those fascinating stories of somebody who did a really horrible thing. He met a young woman. He asked her to marry him the same night that he met her. She finally thought that he was too intense and strange for her and rejected him, and he stalked her, just like any stalker that you might read about in the tabloids, and tried to kill her and mutilated her, mutilated himself. And then after he went to a mental asylum, he was let out because they were compassionate and kind, and he seemed to have gotten better, and he wasn't better at all. It's an amazing story of not being able to see mental illness when somebody decides to act normal.
Yes, it sounds quite modern, doesn't it?
It does.
This kind of thing has been going on forever, and it continues to go on. Yeah, this was sort of the crime that got him started. He was an army sergeant at the time, and yes, he fixated on this young woman, and she rejected him, and he stalked her for months. And at the end, he confronted her and shot her in the head and shot himself in the head, and miraculously, neither was killed. He was then declared, you know, mentally incompetent and sent to an insane asylum. And this was a period in the 1890s when they realized that you couldn't treat a mentally ill person by chaining them to a wall, but that you had to treat them with compassion and use talk therapy. And either because he was an expert manipulator or because some of his symptoms abated, he was let go in a few months, and a few weeks after that, he started his killing spree. It was fascinating to me because I actually found the mental asylum and was able to see the records, the original handwritten records, which document his admission and his manias and his escape and his eventual calming down, at which point they let him go.
It's very interesting to read this book, which I must say is beautifully and vividly written. It's a real page-turner. But it's so interesting to me because, okay, we're talking over 100 years ago, maybe 115 years ago or so, and there is a great familiarity about that time, despite the, you know, five generations gone by. There's these big wealth and class disparities as there are now. There's an urban middle class. There's a belief in progress and science. But there's some big differences, too. And one of them is the inability of law enforcement to operate outside of the big cities. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you're so right. And you can imagine what attracted me to this story. I mean, you know, I was interested in CSI and all that stuff, and to come upon the case that was kind of the beginning of how it all got started, you know, contemporary with Sherlock Holmes, too, and yet, you're right, so many of the things of the period were just like our own. It was the birth of consumer society, the invention of department stores, the bicycle became popular, and yet there was an international terrorist movement. At the time, it was called anarchism. So there was that same kind of excitement about what the future holds, and dread about what the future holds that we have. One of the differences was it was also kind of the beginning of the modern police force and the modern detective agency, and they were fairly well developed in the big cities in Europe. America was a few decades behind, and we could get into that later, but outside the big cities, it was pretty much the Wild West in Europe as well, and I didn't realize that. And in the course of my research, I went to some of the villages where the crimes took place, and even now they're really isolated places where it takes a long time for them to trust a stranger. And they said 100 years ago, you know, they didn't have telegraphs or anything. And he really took advantage of that, and he committed his crimes in these isolated communities and then would move on to the next one before people were able to react to what happened.
And there was, I mean, he'd go to one village, murder somebody, go two villages away, murder somebody else. There was no communication between them. Not only that, but the first village would then incarcerate just some local person who might have had some little grudge or situation with the victim.
Yeah, I was so curious. You know, we use the phrase now collateral damage. And one of the things I wanted to do was not just have, you know, some horrible book and have the victims be sort of cardboard cutout figures, but really probe people's lives, which is why it took so many years. And what I learned was that when he would commit a crime like this, the villagers would find the body of some young person they knew, you know, horribly mutilated, and the whole village would go into post-traumatic stress. I mean, he really traumatized whole villages, and one of the things they would often do would be sort of find a usual suspect, you know, where someone had a grudge against, and there would be a kind of mass hysteria, and a lot of innocent people were either jailed or driven from their villages, you know, by months and months of harassment. And it was really interesting because after he was caught, reporters went back to some of these villages, and even then the villagers had trouble believing the truth. You know, maybe they felt so guilty by the way they had scapegoated people, but it's just amazing the amount of damage that something like this did.
That was a time when there were so-called vagabonds roaming around. These were people who were just drifters who didn't have a place to go. They got work at farms because it was a very much of a rural countryside, so they would get work working on a farm or being a shepherd or something like that. Vagabonds were very much written about. Who were they, and how did people see and understand them?
They were the unemployed of their era, you know, and we have the unemployed of our era, and they don't drift as much. They were probably more like the Dust Bowl vagabonds of our own country. You know, this was when industrialization moved in, and a lot of work that used to be hand-done, whether it was craftsman work or agricultural work, was done by machines, and literally hundreds of thousands of people were thrown out of work. You know, so as again, people thought it was a great time, but really just under that nice surface was terrible misfortune. There was also a blight on the wine crop, which threw more and more people out of work. So there were literally hundreds of thousands of people drifting all over Europe. People would write theses about them. You know, some said, you know, this is just unemployment. But because this was the era of eugenics, some people said, no, somebody is born to be a vagabond and they're another type and they have to be driven away. And this wasn't unique to Europe. In America at that time, there was the so-called army of tramps because there was a recession in the late 1800s. And the city of Chicago, you know, put signs outside, you're not welcome here. And people actually recommended killing some of them as a lesson to the others. So this was not a kind and gentle time, and there were a lot of people on the loose, and Vache sort of blended in with them and you know, used that as a cover to commit his crimes.
And he's such a, I mean, horrifying character. You could make a movie about this guy who sometimes went to a house and just killed somebody, and other times went and shared a lovely meal with them and taught the daughters penmanship.
Yes, yes, you saw that. I actually was able to get a piece of evidence of a penmanship lesson he gave to the family, to the little girl of a family he stayed with. You know, when this broke years later, they were horrified to find that their daughter was sitting on the knee of the worst serial killer in their country's history. But this was, you know, this, if you look at modern sociopaths too, you know, Ted Bundy or the BTK killer, who was a church deacon, I believe, these people are very cunning and they're very skilled at leading double lives. And this guy did too.
We're talking to Doug Starr. His book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. So let's start talking about the birth of forensic science. Let's talk about Dr. Alexandre Lacassagne. Who was he?
I'm happy to be talking to him about him because even talking about Vache gets me depressed. Lacassagne was his opposite, as perverse and as cruel as Vache was. It was almost like Jekyll and Hyde. Lacassagne represented everything that was good about that period in history. He was a brilliant physician, you know, came up through the middle class, and he was one of the inventors of forensic science, so to speak. There was a coterie of scientists throughout Europe, mainly in France and Italy, Germany, Austria, Russia, not so much England and not the U.S. at that time. And they realized that witnesses had trouble telling the truth and that if they could analyze the evidence, it would give physical descriptions of the crime. They called the evidence the silent testimony. And over the years, he and his colleagues, bit by bit, started putting the pieces together of what we now know as forensic science. So this included understanding things like the position of body on death, putrefaction, the insects that colonize a body. He invented the science of ballistics, how wounds affect the body. It was brilliant what they did, and he was the most admired of this entire group. He was world famous in his time.
It's interesting because as you write about it, I try to imagine being one of those people who's involved in that course of study, because this was before there was widespread refrigeration of any kind, and so they were doing autopsies on rotting, stinky, dismembered bodies, and yet for them, they were in a state of great excitement because it was discovery and invention of this whole new field.
It was amazing, and they were very brave. You know, they didn't have masks or gloves. If they pricked themselves, they could get blood poisoning. You know, the smell was awful. Lacassagne worked in a morgue that was based on a barge in the river in Lyon where he was, and they devised a little device that would trickle river water over the bodies to try to keep them cool. But they had to act very fast and very precisely, and he actually developed methods so that even a medical examiner in a remote village who had to do an autopsy on a kitchen table could go by a prescribed series of steps and get an accurate result, which was a very new thing at the time. Now, they were astonishing. And I should say Lacassagne, in addition to looking at how a crime is committed, he was an expert in criminal psychology because he wanted to understand why people committed crimes. And he interviewed hundreds of criminals and collected their writings and their tattoos, and really tried to understand the whole culture of criminality.
Lacassagne invented many of the, or developed many of the basic methods that are, I think, still used today.
Yeah.
So some of the things were performing autopsies, identifying bodies, figuring out the time of death. Just tell us a few examples. Like, what were some of the ways that he figured out to do things that were accurate and have lasted all these years?
One of my favorite ones was how he tripped over the discovery that you could match a bullet to a gun. And this was so typical of him and his curiosity. He was called to a murder scene where a 78-year-old man had been shot repeatedly. And he got a hold of the gun from the suspect. And in doing the autopsy, he noticed that the bullets that struck bone had the same deformations as the bullets that hit the soft tissue. And this was counterintuitive. So he got hold of an expert from a local munitions company who explained to him that the companies would put these spirals, groove these spirals into the barrel of the gun to spin the bullet so it flew straighter. So he would never leave well enough alone. He took the body and his gun back to his institute in Lyon, and he called the hospital nearby and asked if they happened to have a recently deceased 8-year-old man of the same size. And he then took the gun and shot the corpse several times in soft and hard places and microscopically examined the bullets. And this was the discovery that bullets matched the gun. And then he had a graduate student do the same with about 28 other kind of guns. And this was how the science of ballistics was formed. So every time he came upon an interesting case, and I should say this extends to his colleagues throughout Europe, they would examine it, do science, write it up, and then they had scientific journals and meetings. And it was really witnessing the birth of a science.
Another part of it was figuring out how long a body had been dead, so they could do from a couple of hours to, I think, a couple of years, based partially on the insects that colonized a body in a very systematic way.
Yeah, this was a colleague of his in Paris, because this was a problem to know, you know, how long had a body been there. So they understood rigor mortis and that that proceeds on a timetable and how a body kind of rots away. But his colleague named Magnin in Paris over the years had been studying insects, and he called them, you know, insects of the tombs. And he figured out that different species of insects colonize the body at very particular times and that you could date it for years based on it. This is still used, by the way. All of these techniques are still used, and these were the people who pioneered them.
Another part of as you were talking about, the whole set of questions was the set of questions that we're still asking today, namely, why do people commit these horrifying crimes? Mm-hmm. And there were various schools of thought on that question. Describe what the lay of the land looked like in terms of the philosophy of that question.
Yes. Now, to set it up, another reason this period was so interesting is it was the birth of a lot of modern science. So Darwin was still alive, you know, the theory of evolution. Freud was alive, which meant psychology was being born. Pasteur was alive, which meant germ theory was being born. And there was this whole notion that all of these sciences put together could help understand almost any problem confronting humanity. So they had this problem that there was a lot of crime, and naturally the scientists wondered, why would this be? And before this, the idea was that people who commit crimes are either evil or too weak to resist Satan's influence, and that was that. He had it becoming a science. So in Italy, there was a famous psychologist named Lombroso who theorized that because of evolutionary accidents, every once in a while, a kind of person is born who is biologically destined to commit crimes. And this person he called the criminal man or the born criminal. And he bore out his theory by doing autopsies of hundreds of criminals and claimed to find certain malformations of the brain which express themselves in a kind of person who looks like a criminal, you know, the thuggish kind of look. And this was a very popular theory. Now, Lacassagne opposed the theory. He'd done his own studies, but he also studied the economics and the family structure and the social structure of criminals, and he really believed that criminals were made and not born. So these two and their followers filled scientific journals with their papers, and every 4 years there were massive conferences in which these things were debated. And I should say that debate continues now. You know, it's the original nature-nurture debate, and right now people still argue whether somebody is born with these tendencies or learns them throughout their life.
And there's also the added dimension of what physiological damage might have occurred, as in the case, for example, of Joseph Vacher.
Yes. Of course, he was showing signs of being a psychotic before he ever shot himself. But this is, you know, the interplay of your experiences and how they affect the growth of the brain and the way your brain is and how they affect the way you react to things is one that people don't quite understand. But it's so fascinating to think that this science, which is now being conducted with MRI and huge amounts of technology, was actually pioneered by people doing dissections without gloves or masks in the 1890s.
So let's go back to Vacher. What was his childhood like? When did his family start to realize that there was something not quite right about their son?
Yeah, he grew up in a small town outside Lyon in the hills, a peasant family with lots of siblings, and he seemed okay until he was 10 or so. He had these clerical tendencies. He loved to preach. And then his family claimed he was licked by a rabid dog, and they gave him a folk medicine, after which he began to act strange. Now, Dr. Lacassagne and I believe it was just a coincidence, because you don't get licked by a rabid dog and have a behavioral issue. You either don't get rabies or you die. But after that, he started exhibiting typical sociopathic behavior. If kids played a trick on him, instead of laughing, he would try to kill them. Sometimes when he was tending the farm animals, he would torture them. He was violent and surly. So right about the time of his prepubescence, he started showing the first signs of being maladjusted, and it just got worse. And then it was in his 20s when it really, you know, became a full-fledged psychosis.
As I'm reading the book and kind of seeing it like a movie, there's this moment after he tries to kill his would-be girlfriend, or he wishes would be his girlfriend, Louise, and, you know, tries to kill her, tries to kill himself, and then he goes to this asylum, and he's continually trying to do himself in, and I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm a bad person, but I just kept hoping, why didn't they just let him do it? He clearly didn't want to live, and what harm he did.
He, you know, they couldn't have expected that, and like even now, you know, people are not permitted to commit suicide. It's not a good thing. And they thought they could treat him. It's very interesting because while I was doing this work and collecting all of these documents in old handwritten French, I was also talking to modern psychologists and modern neurologists in an attempt to understand what this stuff might mean. And like you, I was haunted by the idea of why did they let this guy go? You know, why didn't they keep him locked up forever? And I was talking to some forensic psychologists, and they said it's very possible that he suffered a comorbidity, which meant he suffered from more than one thing. Everybody I spoke to said he was your standard psychopath. No empathy for anybody. He saw other people as objects and not as people, and he did what he wanted. But he also seemed to suffer from schizophrenia, which is what caused some of his delusions and some of his auditory hallucinations. Schizophrenics generally are not violent. And they said it's possible that in the asylum, you know, the crazy outbursts and all those symptoms were schizophrenia, which really could have abated over the months of very gentle treatment. But the psychologists at the time couldn't have known that underlying this was the basic psychopathic personality trait, which only came out during certain times. I mean, we'll never know, but this is one of the enduring and haunting mysteries of that book.
Even in contemporary psychologists who deal with criminals and psychopaths and sociopaths and violent schizophrenics and all of that, there are these moments, and you describe one of them, where a psychologist is in the presence of an imprisoned psychopath and says looking into his eyes was like looking into pure evil, and it kind of seemed to transcend any medical ability to really understand it.
Yeah, that was so interesting. One of the psychologists I spoke to in the States deals with serial killers, and she's interviewed the famous ones, and we were talking, and she's talking about psychopathology and all that. And after a couple of hours, I said, is there any experience that just stands out in your mind? And she said, yes, there was one serial killer, and looking into his eyes, I felt like I was looking into pure evil. And I said, doctor, wait a minute, you're a scientist. Do you realize what you've just said? That's not science. And she says, I know, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but I felt like I brushed up against the abyss. And you know what? She's not the only person I heard that from. I was interviewing another forensic psychologist who said one time in her career, she came up against the same thing. So, you know, to me, this is a story of forensics, and it's a story of criminal psychology. But what really also pulls me into a story like this is there are these eternal questions we all wrestle with, which is, you know, what is human nature and what is the source of the instinct to do good and the instinct to do evil? And I get the impression that psychologists and neurologists are getting closer and closer to understanding, you know, how this instinct might make its way through the brain and through our personality patterns. But we really aren't that close to understanding, you know, why that instinct exists in some people in the first place.
We're talking to Doug Starr about his book, The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. Let's go back once again to the horrible and notorious Joseph Vaché. How was he caught?
So interesting. He was so clever. And he so well evaded capture, and sometimes he'd be in jail for misdemeanor and act innocent and be let out. But one day in I believe it was August of 1897, he attacked a woman who was out collecting pine cones in the forest, and he didn't know that deeper in the forest was her husband, and her children were nearby. And her husband came running, and then the villagers came running, and they physically subdued him. and they brought him to a nearby tavern and tied him up and got the authorities who took him away to a small jail. Now, this could have been like any other time in which he was temporarily caught and let go. But meanwhile, there was an investigator in a town on the other side of France named Emile Fourquet, who read up on all the modern methods. And there had been a horrible murder in his town, too. And he read about another murder, and he wondered if any of these crimes were connected. So he sent a telegraph to all the magistrates of France and said, if you have any unexplained brutal killings, and if you have any unidentified vagabonds, send me some descriptions. And he got a lot of telegrams, and he made huge charts. He worked nights and weekends of all the physical descriptions of unknown characters and all the crime scene descriptions of brutal murders. And then he circled in blue all the common elements. And he thus created what probably was the first modern criminal profile. And after that, he sent out another telegram to all the magistrates and said, if you see this kind of person who looks like this, and if you have these kind of murders, you may be encountering the man they are calling the Jack the Ripper of France, and contact me immediately. Meanwhile, this jailer in this small town where Vacher was kept read the memo and contacted Emile Fourquet and said, I may have your guy.
So once Vacher was caught and identified for who he was, then the next question is, how do you pin the crime on him? And this is, again, a question that is as modern as any question. How do you interrogate the guy to get a confession? And the whole question of interrogation methods was something that was also, along with everything else, being developed at that time.
Yes, absolutely fascinating. You know, and it's especially pertinent now because this whole question of torture has come up. But in the 1880s, the Austrian criminologist Hans Gross wrote extensively about the art of interrogation. And of course, I got his writings, and I was fascinated to see that he wrote, the one thing you must never do in an interrogation is torture the person or cause them discomfort, because they'll just say what they think they need to say. He said you have to use cleverness and wit and go over the same material. And he said eventually the criminal will find the need to unburden himself to you. So let's get back to what was happening. So Emile Fourquet had figured out this profile, and the local jailer sent Vacher, you know, with police on a train to Fourquet's jurisdiction. And Fourquet interrogated him for days and days and days and realized he wasn't getting anywhere. And Fourquet had read up on the modern methods. He realized this Vacher was too clever for him. So he tried one final trick, and he said, listen, Vacher, I realize I've made a mistake. They sent the wrong guy. I'm going to let you go, but it's going to take me 3 days to clear up the paperwork. So if you don't mind, stay here. You know, we'll feed you. You know, we'll hold on to you. And meanwhile, I'm writing a book about vagabonds. Why don't we be colleagues, and why don't you tell me about your life as a vagabond? And he was writing such a book. So over the days, they started talking, and Vacher started telling him about his life as a vagabond and where he went and what happened to him. And Fourquet would make maps. And if you look in the book, I believe I have a copy of one of the maps he made of France. And then at night, he would go home and map out the crimes. And after a few days, he got a perfect fit, the crimes and where Vacher had been. So finally, after several days of this, he had him dead to rights. He said, Joseph Vacher, I accuse you of the murder of, and he rattled off one murder after the other. Perfect precision. And he said Vacher just went white, and he almost collapsed in shock. And later that day, when Fourquet was having dinner, there's a knock on the door, and it's the guard, and he hands him a piece of paper, and it's Joseph Vacher's written confession. Now, that was just the beginning, because, as you know, the confession was incoherent, and it was clear that from this moment forth, Vacher was going to try to really make a case for the insanity defense and once more get off. And at this point, Fourquet realized that was the level he could take things, and he contacted Dr. Lacassagne to move the case forward to his conclusion. So that's how the greatest criminal mastermind of Europe had to match wits with the greatest criminal of Europe.
And it's interesting because, as you say, he almost really messed up, because this whole art of interrogation starts very, very slowly, and he made a misstep early on, which made Vacher not trust him. And once you lose that trust, you're kind of screwed.
It was fascinating. You're right. He jumped the gun and accused him too early. Said, "I know you've been there." And Vache pulled back, and 4K had to regroup. And you know, he wrote extensively about this interrogation. And then for the trial, he had to create, you know, handwritten records. So I have all of the interrogations, which took place over weeks. And it's fascinating to see the battle of wits that took place between them. And, of course, equally fascinating because the next stage was the battle of wits between Vache and Dr. Lacassagne, who had to show whether or not he was insane and what they would do with this serial killer.
So what did that look like?
Fascinating. They sent Vache down to the St. Paul prison in Lyon, and over a period of 5 months, Lacassagne interrogated him constantly. And again, he too couldn't lose his temper. The interesting thing was, I mentioned earlier that Lacassagne tried to understand the criminal mind, and the criminals actually liked him, because every Sunday, Lacassagne would walk over to the big St. Paul prison, which was, you know, it looked like a castle, and he would chat with the criminals and have them keep diaries, and he would give them pens and paper because he wanted to understand them. And they, in turn, loved him because he was the only person that ever tried to hear what they had to say. So Lacassagne thought he could get to Vache in the same way, and he had him keep a diary, and he talked to him about his childhood. But Vache was too malicious. Every time he would begin to soften, he'd pull back and say, "You think you could trick me, you and all of your fake knowledge?" And he would get very arrogant. He would fake starvation strikes, and it would turn out that people were slipping him food. So after months of this, Lacassagne realized he'd met his match in terms of interrogation, but he had another trick up his sleeve, and that Lacassagne, as we know, was the master of forensic analysis. So he collected the crime scene reports and the witness reports and the autopsy reports of all the crimes, and he spent months studying them and looking for patterns that would indicate whether Vache acted methodically or impulsively. So I said earlier, the interesting thing was, not only did Lacassagne and his colleagues look to the evidence to say what happened, but they looked to see why it happened and actually why the criminal had the state of mind that he did. And this ultimately was Lacassagne's triumph, to be able to take this evidence, some of which was quite old and quite partial, and put together a pattern that ultimately proved Vache's guilt and sanity.
How did he prove his sanity?
He, and you see one of the drawings in the book, but I was able to find all of the crime scene drawings. When you see the pattern that he analyzes, and you see the layout of the crime scene, you can see that Vache acted with forethought, that he took great care, that he didn't just act on impulse, that he was clever. And these are the same standards that apply to serial killers today. You know, you or I see a serial killer and say, "This guy has to be crazy. No sane person would do this." But according to the legal statutes, if somebody knows what they're doing and can plan it and knows the difference from right and wrong, they are legally sane. And this is what Lacassagne was able to do by putting together all of these pieces. And not only did he write a very compelling report, but it was amazing in the trial, you know, on the third and final day when the trial had pretty much broken down in complete chaos because Vache had tried to turn it into a circus, you know, the effect that Lacassagne's authoritative testimony had on bringing out this evidence and showing his method. It was really a brilliant piece of police work, forensic work, psychology. It was really, really something.
There is something odd, and I don't say that it's wrong, but of somehow associating insanity with impulsiveness, so that if there's forethought, it's not insanity.
It is odd, and as you know, at the very end of the book, I can't let go of that question. And even though they found Vache guilty and sent him to the guillotine, and as you know, later they autopsied his brain to find out what might have been going on, to this day, I can't think of a serial killer who's found to be insane. Even the most horrible, Jeffrey Dahmer, who, you know, ate people, was found sane. There is this intersection of the law and psychiatry in which certain boundaries have been set and certain rules have been set that maybe work for the legal system, but for us as human beings who are curious about human nature, I don't think we're satisfied by that. And people are looking into, maybe it's time to redefine what sanity is, because certainly nobody who kills one person after the other could be sane.
I think, I mean, certainly wrapped up in it is the question not of the truth about sanity or insanity, but the practical consideration of what you want done with these people. And as a society, I think we've chosen that locking them up, we've just decided that locking them up for life, or in some cases, he got the guillotine, the death penalty, is more appropriate than putting them in an asylum with perhaps overly compassionate, and I'm not against compassion, but overly compassionate doctors that might let them out.
You're absolutely right. These are the uncomfortable choices that we're dealing with and have been for over a century. Of course, a big danger at the turn of the century is the asylums had terrible security and people broke out a lot. And now if somebody is put in an institution for the criminally insane, they're not getting out. Some states have a statute that allows somebody to be pronounced guilty but insane. Some states have the death penalty. I don't think as a society or as a civilization we've really come to grips about what to do with this. Certainly somebody who kills a lot of people should never be allowed out into circulation, and yet do you just put them in a cage or do you try to find a way to treat them? These are open questions. They were open questions then, and they're very troubling questions to this day.
We're talking to Doug Starr. His book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. I find it fascinating that there is a whole subculture of people who want to go into forensics, who want to study serial killers, who want to study dead bodies and so on, because for me, reading it, I mean, it's like a journey into another world, but it certainly isn't a world that I want to stay in. Having studied serial killers and so on, what are your thoughts about the psychology of people who make their life looking at these things?
That's so interesting. Well, there are those professionals, and there's this huge fan base who likes to watch all of these shows, you know, CSI shows and all that. You know, at the time that the book took place, there was a very popular detective named Sherlock Holmes who possessed all the mystical powers that we see on the CSI shows. Even though his science was not quite there, there was that same mania for this kind of a character. And I've been thinking a lot about this. I think, you know, these are scary times, and I think even after 9/11, times have become scarier where, you know, we think we're okay, but things aren't certain. There are people out there who want to get us, even though crime right now is at an all-time low. Anxiety is an all-time high. And I think the enthusiasm for all things forensic is the notion that at a time when there are malevolent forces at bay, you know, who bring danger and chaos to what we hope to be an orderly society, I think it gives us great confidence and restores our faith, knowing that there are smart people out there rounding up these bad guys, using science and intellect to sort of restore safety and order. And I think that's why we're willing to, you know, accept these shows that are kind of fantastical, and we're so enthusiastic about them, because there's this knowledge of, look, these may be scary times, but there are some real professionals out there who know how to put things right again. I think that's behind the appeal of these things.
What was the media like at that time, and how is it similar to or different from our current media where it comes to looking at people like serial killers?
It was just as nuts as the media is now. that was the striking thing. I mean, now we've got cable and podcasts and all sorts of extreme forms where people really feel no compunction about communicating in a hysterical way. The late 19th century saw the birth of the tabloid press, and there was a saying in the U.S. and in Europe, you know, the bloody stuff goes on page one. They had newsstands, and they had to compete for the eyes of their viewers. So they loved crime, and they would trumpet it, and there were melodramatic drawings of people getting killed. So it was really the birth of the crazy mass media, and they amped things up as much as the mass media amped things up right now.
And you have on the cover of the book and inside the book, these very detailed, what are they, engravings of?
Yeah, they're lithographs.
Lithographs of Vacher killing these poor, unfortunate victims.
This was a, and these were from the tabloid press. They're not photos, but they're artist renderings, you know, showing them the mad act of getting ready to stab some poor girl who's in mid shriek. And this is how they got readers. You know, and I should say, we spoke earlier about the fact that some villagers prosecuted innocent people among them. Oftentimes, these prosecutions were amped up by the local media, you know, who were trying to get readers. So things change, but they don't change that much, do they?
I also was kind of intrigued by this account of all the people, and there were many of them also, who got away. How did they do it, who were about to be victims of Vache and then somehow escaped?
Well, there were a few. He was very effective. I mean, he had this technique where he'd come up behind someone and grab them by the throat so hard that they would drop, and then he would dispatch them with a knife. But there was a woman, I think one Easter near Lyon, selling oranges. And he grabbed her, and she started shrieking and broke free and started throwing rocks, and some villagers came by. There was a little girl, again, within earshot of somebody, and then this final victim. It's very interesting what he did. You know, he stalked so cleverly that there rarely were any people within earshot or within sight lines. I was in a remote village during my research where one of the kids was killed, and I found the village elders who were in their 90s, and we would chat for hours, and I said, "Do you have any ancestral memories of this?" He said, "Oh, yeah, oh, yeah." He said, "My grandmother told me about it." And apparently his grandmother was on the same hillside where one of these people was killed, and Vache started coming after her, but then he saw another farm worker in the distance and didn't want any witnesses, so he took off. And this old farmer, his 90s, said, "You know, but for that moment, I might never have been born." So he was very effective at finding people in isolation, but every once in a while he'd slip, and on that final slip he finally got caught.
There is a cast of Vache's brain, a plaster cast of his brain, that has survived all of these years. Why did they make plaster casts of those brains, and what, if anything, was learned from them?
This was the birth of the science of neurology, and this was when the father of neurology, Paul Broca, understood that aphasia, the inability to talk, was caused by the malformation of a brain. And this was a period where, in order to understand the workings of the brain, scientists would have, say, a mental patient or a patient who had certain deficiencies, and when the person died, they would autopsy the brain and sort of reverse, by using reverse logic, figure, oh, this part is atrophied, that must be the control of this. There was also that famous case of Phineas Gage, who, the American, who a railroad spike went through the frontal lobe of his brain, and even though he survived, it changed his personality. So there was a tremendous enthusiasm for anything involving the brain, and they would routinely autopsy the brains of killers. So they, after Vache was guillotined, they did dissect him, and before they took his brain apart, they did a plaster cast. And that was so people in the future could examine the surface and see if there was anything unusual. There was so much enthusiasm for his brain that they then sent it to Paris and actually divided up among many of the great neurologists of Europe who wanted to do microscopic examinations of the nerve cells and see if anything turned up.
And was anything learned from his brain?
Not really. Some people thought they saw some inflammations of certain areas, but they were more associated with the syphilis that he probably had. But no, there was no serious functional deformity, and that in itself led to huge debates over whether it was a behavioral thing or maybe it was a chemical imbalance. You know, the issue was never settled. People doing state-of-the-art neurology are now doing MRI scans of the brains of psychotic criminals, and they're beginning to find interesting patterns of how certain parts of the brains are not functioning in coordination with others. So this whole question about whether the brain structure or the brain function affects criminal behavior, this whole discussion is very much alive.
The book is called The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. Forensic science has remarkably built very, very much on this foundation. How has it changed, and how much are we still using the basic tools that were developed then. You mentioned ballistics before.
Yeah, ballistics, dating the time of death. They, Lakhassani and his colleagues, figured out blood spatter analysis, in which they would look under tables and all other places for the distribution and shapes of blood drops. This is very much important today. I would say just about the only stuff we have that they didn't was shortly after their time, fingerprints became used, and DNA analysis. But everything else, including hair and fiber analysis, they pioneered. Blood types, blood cells, body position, rigor mortis. It's astonishing how much they did, and almost everything that we do now is based on the foundations that these people laid.
You mentioned before that the fear of crime is very high right now, but the actual crime rate is very low compared to documented past times of in the 20th century. Now, when I read your book and see all the people who were untreated mental patients who were syphilitic and so on, to what extent do you attribute the fall in crime rate to the actual medical intervention and understanding of things that cause people to be violent criminals?
I think that's part of it. I think also in those days they overdiagnosed insanity, so anybody who was old and maybe had a little dementia was put in an institution. I mean, there was a downside as well. But I think a lot of things have contributed to the decline in crime. One, of course, is early intervention. The other is the police are getting very sophisticated about working with gangs and seeing that you don't just wait for somebody to do something and then lock them up, but there are ways of having social interventions. They say that the cohort of young men who committed crimes has kind of moved up and out. And it's just, there's a much more sophisticated approach to understanding crime now. It doesn't mean we don't have problems. You know, we still have a higher crime rate than most of Europe. But what I find interesting is that the anxiety about crime is probably out of proportion to the crime itself. I think part of that may be due to the mass media. If you look at your local news shows, they tend to highlight crime as opposed to policy issues, because it's much less expensive to send a cameraman to a crime scene instead of having somebody really work through an issue. And the media tend to amp up crime. And then as people spend more and more time indoors watching TV, studies have shown that those people who spend the least time outside and the most time inside on TV get a disproportionate amount of crime information from TV shows and the news, and they tend to have more anxiety about it.
And perhaps a bit more fear of the great unknown called the area outside their house.
Yes, and you know, all of the studies in looking at how people relate to minority groups or people who are different than them, the best way to break that down is to meet somebody who's different than you and realize there's not much to fear. This is an ongoing problem, and it's one of the few large problems I actually didn't get into in this particular book, but it certainly is. It's out there in terms of this whole question of crime and the human condition and how we live with fear. Yeah.
Doug Starr is author of the book The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science, a total page-turner. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Chris, so much. Great conversation.